Hello and welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast. I'm Mark Williams and I'm the contributing editor for Ship.Energy, and I'm your host for today and indeed for this series of podcasts. To take a moment for a quick introduction, Ship.Energy is the new free-to-access digital insights platform published by Petrospot Limited, the leading provider of marine fuels industry information and intelligence. The job of Ship.Energy is to track shipping's course to a zero emissions future through the provision of news, intelligence, and collaborative discussion. The Ship.Energy podcast will generate conversations exploring the challenges and opportunities of the zero emissions journey. Now, in each of these episodes of this podcast, I will be joined by leading experts from the shipping industry and from overlapping disciplines in the energy, technology, financial, and regulatory sectors. Today, we're excited to launch our inaugural podcast with a leading ship owner's perspective on the zero emissions journey. And we're very pleased to welcome Mr. Mark Cameron, the Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of Ardmore Shipping, to kick off our discussions. And just to introduce Mark, Mark has been with Ardmore since its foundation in 2010. He's a former chairman of the International Parcel Tankers Association. He's on the board of the West of England P&I Club and is also an advisory board member to the NGO Carbon War Room. He has a long and distinguished career in shipping, but that doesn't stop him being youthful and enthusiastic, and we're very happy to have him with us today. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm excited to be your guinea pig in the new venture.
Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate you joining us, and we don't want to keep the listeners waiting too long, so I'm going to just jump in with my first question. And this is a question that I'm going to be asking all of the ship owners who appear on the podcast, really. And it comes down to this. If we're going to go along this zero emissions journey, then there has to be a commercial reason for doing so. There has to be commercial viability. So the first question really is, has Ardmore found that there is a financial reward, or do you expect a commercial advantage to reducing air emissions or emissions to air of gases from your vessels?
Well, you know, when I read your intro, I thought, yeah, that's an interesting opening line, because you're probably getting right to the nub of business. And it's a question that doesn't honestly have a simple answer. And, you know, the honest answer is that we're in business, obviously, to make money. That's that. And there's no shame in that. How we go about making our money is obviously with a level of integrity. And our integrity stretches to the boundaries of having an environmentally responsible approach to operating our ships. Now, that rolls off the tongue very easily when you're sitting in a nice home environment. But what does it translate to in real hard terms? The truth is, it costs money, and you have to be prepared to invest in an environmental strategy. And then the question on the return of it is perhaps a little abstract. On one level, you could certainly say that it does enable you to get business. It enables you to transact, and it enables you to transact with some partners who look for a level of a commitment to an environmental agenda. That's all well and good. That cannot translate in hard terms to a numerical value that you say, this is the value of us having a certain kind of strategy. So I think if there is a saving in fuel, it translates to a lower operating cost. And that logic has to prevail throughout many of your operating philosophies. So burning less fuel is good for returns. So take that as point number one. Point number two, there are those who look for not just a poster on the wall, a track record in doing things, actually being able to demonstrate approaches that you're taking or ways that you're operating your business. And this might come through the form of audits. It might come through, as with us, in our published figures. We were, the first tanker company to publish our emissions, certainly through our quarterly earnings. And, you know, taking that type of lead for us was a very natural sort of event. So if I'm not sure if that answers you directly, it's perhaps an enabler to doing business more than an immediate measurable financial reward.
Sure. Yeah. Now I know Max Berglund, who I think is on the non-exec board at Ardmore. Max Berglund once said at a ship owners forum where I was on the panel, said that having an environmental policy is, it doesn't mean that you get an extra 5 cents per ton on your freight rate. It's the difference between getting the cargo and not getting the cargo. And that's how he perceives the difference and what makes a quality shipping organization. Would you agree with that?
That's probably a much more succinct answer than the one that I just gave you. But yes, indeed, that's the basic idea behind it.
So, Ardmore has a policy, has an environmental policy, has an environmental strategy. Of course, you always have the IMO's carbon reduction goals in mind at the moment. And I was wondering, does your experience of the enforcement of IMO 2020 give you any clues as to how you're going to work towards the IMO's CO2 reduction goals?
Yeah, I think, firstly, let me just say that, you know, IMO 2020 was a relative non-event for us. We managed the transition pretty easily. I think we managed the transition at a time that was very advantageous. It was in late December, so we didn't spend, you know, kind of enormous amount of money in sort of the early Q4 phase of 2019. Has that experience translated into learning for 2030? I think they're very different. I think there was a very clear expectation of what you needed to do on the 1st of January 2020. The 2030 IMO CO2 aspiration is very different. There is no clear-cut approach towards how the industry should meet these targets. So I think they're very different in their intent. I'm not here to defend our position on burning compliant fuel versus the whole scrubber debate. I think that's very much played out one way or the other, depending on individual companies' positions. But I will say that when we did look at the whole scrubber discussion, There is no doubt that it does consume more fuel, and that fuel translates into an increased carbon dioxide discharge from a ship, and that has to play a part in your understanding of the big picture emission debate. In that decisions you make in one camp might very well impact another area, and you know whether it's 2% or 3% of an increased consumption. 2 or 3 hard-earned percent reduction is very difficult to achieve on a modern ship these days. So for us, in that sense, didn't make environmental sense. And, you know, the financial impact of it was indeed a secondary discussion.
Yes, fuel consumption is a key step, isn't it, on the way to achieving these goals. We have the EEDI. Already we have engine efficiency targets that have come in over the last 10 years, and ships are becoming much more efficient in the way they burn fuel. You get more miles per gallon out of a ship engine these days than you did even 10 years ago.
Well, there's still a lot of discussion around that, isn't there? I saw George Prokopiou at Cyprus Maritime 2019 in October last year, where I was hosting a panel, and he, on a ship owner panel there, promoted speed limits as a clear way to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. And of course, it effectively reduces ship supply. So it improves the balance of supply and demand in favor of ship owners. But as a means of reducing shipping's carbon footprint, do you think that speed limits are a practicable solution in the long term?
again, no one size fits all answer to this. I think if you look at the container industry and you consider, you know, some of the speeds that the large container ships were designed for versus what they currently operate at, you could probably argue that there's a large sector of the fleet already operating at a speed that is below design speed. But that then raises the question, what is design speed? And why is design speed in a new build pegged at some arbitrary number? And I think everything then is molded around a speed that is very different probably from what the operating environment calls for. So is speed the solution? I don't think so. I think it's part of a solution. I think it helps in a certain way. What it can also help to do is reduce the impact of the number of ships that are on the market, supply and demand. I mean, from your background, you're well aware of the desire for ship owners to have new ships every time there's a market force that seems to indicate that it's a good idea to go out and build more ships. So slowing down ships could translate in certain circumstances to, you know, more ships being ordered, which doesn't necessarily help the discussion. If you're in a container service and you've got a liner service that's on a named day service and you just slow them down, it can end up in just adding another ship to a string. You know, in our way of thinking, that's not the solution. The real solution here is an approach that understands the trade, understands the world need for the movement of goods, understands what it means to look at port congestion and consider the arrival times of goods within that bigger sphere of operating context, and look for efficiency across the board, not just singularly at what speed a ship is traveling at.
Sure. I think there's a lot of discussion to be had yet about the optimization of vessel utilization, you know, to increase the capacity utilization on a per ship basis. But I think an awful lot of activity has to take place there, doesn't it? About interconnectedness and routing and sort of stuff, which we're not going to get into in this podcast, but definitely it raises some interesting questions. And I just want to zoom out a little bit then, because some of the things that are happening at the moment, like slow steaming or scrubbers, aren't necessarily going to advance us very far down the path to the carbon reduction goals. But more generally, do you think the IMO's carbon reduction goals are actually achievable or practical?
Well, first of all, I think the IMO is the place and is the proper place for the decision making in this area, and that shipping should be controlled by the IMO. I support that theory. I do think that the decision making processes within the IMO in this regard are probably going to come under a lot of pressure around them creating tighter beyond just guidelines into regulation. So are they achievable? Well, I think they have to be. I think we need to move on from the discussion of are they achievable to how do we make this happen? I think the recent review of the our emissions, the latest greenhouse gas study, has surprised a lot of people, including myself, that I thought we would have been doing a lot better than has been reflected. So that's perhaps deflated the happiness balloon around where we thought we might be. So more needs to be done. I think when the industry has time now to sit back and reflect, we're going to have to go, more has to be done more urgently, more quickly, with more perhaps precision in terms of saying, this is what we need to do to achieve those goals. I feel that 2030's target is achievable, but it needs more common thinking. And what I see at the moment is a lot of independent thought, a lot of independent action. And the problem with that is it can become like herding cats, where as an industry, we're all running around trying to find, dare I say, competitive advantage somewhere in all of this. And there are those who will just sit on the sidelines and perhaps continue to operate as they were and wait for, you know, the clock to strike 12 and see what you know, Cinderella's wearing to the ball. I think we need a way that the enforcement of the change can be better articulated. We you know, 2030 is only really 9 years away. I think we can write this year off pretty much. And 9 years in the evolution of an industry in reduction like we're talking about is not long. It is actually a microcosm of the time. And I think the challenge is enormous. The willpower is great. The technologies are, I would not say that the technologies are, the solution is apparent. I think we still got a lot of work to do on that level to reach 2030. We have our own ideas, of course.
Quite so. There are a number of different organizations, whether they're commercial organizations or NGOs or research institutions, developing new fuels or improvements to vessel design, to engine efficiency, better access to renewable power sources, or shoreside infrastructure, cold ironing, and so on. What do you see as being the most important or the most achievable methods or tools for delivering the IMO's carbon reduction targets? Let's just go out to 2030 for that.
Yeah, I think, again, because there is such a wide array of ships out there trading in the ocean with a vast difference in their operating norms, trying to peg it down into what is the one sort of area is a difficult one. Personally, my personal view is that the first change by 2030 will come in the replacement of the electrical generation on board ships with a more renewable source. I think in our case, if we were to lose the ability to burn anywhere from 2 to 2.8 tons of fuel a day on a generator and replace that with something more renewable, certainly in a stable electrical load environment, that could go a long way to reducing our at-sea load. I think the generator discussion is kind of being dwarfed very often by, you know, the main propulsion discussion. And I would encourage people to think more about starting small. Electrical generation is a large consumer. They're four-stroke engines as opposed to two-stroke, and therefore, by design, less efficient. And I think that the power demand, being so much smaller, is more manageable for us on a renewable basis. I'm not saying that I have that answer up my sleeve, but I do believe that that is the nugget to unlock for a 2030 strategy compliance.
I think certainly it will come some distance. It will take us some distance along the road, wouldn't it? So do you think it's possible to retrofit those systems, those generator systems, onto existing ships? Is that going to be part of Ardmore's vision of the 2030 goal?
I think pretty much anything is going to have a retrofit element attached to it, unless you're, and again, there are multiple approaches towards scrapping older ships and older tonnage, but older tonnage is not necessarily less efficient. I think that's a misnomer. There are different degrees to which older tonnage is actually perhaps more efficient in terms of cargo carriage, et cetera. Do I think retrofitting will you know, kind of continue? Yes, it will. And I think for the generator discussion that I was talking about, that's probably a lot more palatable in terms of a capitalization and return on investment and lifespan of a ship than you know, some of the more radical transformations that are needed for main engines.
Sure, yeah. And talking about the main engines, do you think that if shipping is to switch into alternative fuels, do you think it's going to be possible to retrofit main engines onto a lot of older ships?
I'm not a proponent of, and I know this might not be very popular in some quarters, of the LNG, you know, kind of solution. And if you are looking at LNG, it's perhaps a stopgap on a path to further reductions in CO2. So if I talk about retrofitting, I'm not thinking along those lines myself. I think that the discussions around ammonia and hydrogen are very interesting. How that fuel is then going to be used in the propulsion sense is a question. The ammonia burning in the reciprocating engine is certainly a possibility that's being looked into, which in that particular case would probably mean a retrofit option is possible in not in every case, but certainly probably in the more electronic engine environments. Mm-hmm. But with hydrogen, it might be something else entirely that's needed. I think ultimately, at the end of the day, what needs to be brought into the discussion is, you know, are you expecting to lose cargo carriage capacity as a result of a need to reconfigure fuel tank storage and whatever propulsion mechanism you're talking about? And I think that's an open-ended question still at this point, because, you know, that's a measure of efficiency, ultimately, what volume of cargo you're able to carry.
Of course. And in fact, naval architects and shipyards have been doing excellent work for years now, haven't they, about getting more cargo into the same dimensions.
Exactly. Yes.
Rates have gone up a lot over the last decade or two, certainly. And that will presumably increase in the future. But it sounds like, would you agree with this? It sounds like that it's not just how we affect the engine and fuel storage design of our ships, but that we might end up redesigning the way ships are built altogether in order to accommodate alternative fueling technology.
I think that's a fundamental inevitability. And I think that in the end, if the reciprocating engine was to be replaced by something that has, you know, kind of more of an electrical drive element attached to it, as a lot of ships today actually are, so it's not entirely a new idea to, you know, to have the electrical component of propulsion being an option, then yes, you've got a fundamental redesign of an engine room as we know it. And we know that the heat element of, you know, kind of extraction of heat and utilization of heat and losses that are associated with heat in a reciprocating engine, will be very much replaced perhaps with, you know, a fuel cell idea that could very well, you know, have very different dimensions attached to it.
Sure, yeah. I think certainly by 2030, we're going to be in a situation where we're going to have prototypes of several different alternatives afloat, aren't we? And we may eventually get to the point where we have a dreadnought situation where, you know, entire fleets become obsolete because the new designs have come along. But we're certainly not there yet, are we?
Well, I think it's likely the old VHS versus Betamax, which is probably an era that we're both familiar with discussion. And, you know, at the end of the day, you don't want to be choosing the Betamax, you know, that becomes perhaps technologically sound, but less popular in terms of overall infrastructure.
Quite so. And nobody wants to spend their money on the failing technology, do they? Which, you know, which I think leads to a very interesting question about who's going to fund development of this new fleet fueled by alternative fuel sources and alternative technology, because a dearth of new building funding around at the moment.
Yeah, it's of course, you know, where there's a competitive advantage, there's a natural, you know, kind of funding ROI built into it. But what you're talking about here is something of a very different nature. And of course, the R&D campaign that's been put forward through IMO channels is one example of an industry looking to self-fund. I think it's very important that in the event that we are talking about any form of taxation or let's call it levy for want of another word, that the funds remain in sector. And I think by that, what I mean is if we are going to be contributing financially by whatever form of mechanism, those funds need to be retained within the marine sphere and be utilized for the specific purposes that entails. Now, I don't for a second think that the the world's carbon discussion is going to be solved by the shipping industry. I think there's going to be learnings that come from the railroad industry, from land transportation of all sorts, from infrastructures that those elements of transport ultimately are able to bring to the shipping industry. But the adaptation of what the rest of the world is and what the rest of industry is looking at is going to be where we need to spend our money wisely. Ships engines are large power plants. The need for power in a condensed form, in a high impact condensed form, is pretty unique on a world scale. But I think there will be lessons that we can learn from other industries, particularly railroad.
Certainly, I think that it's going to be a solution that applies not just to shipping, is it? It's going to apply to all forms of transport, whether that's land, aviation, or shipping as well. So. Well, Mark, I really appreciate you coming on and being our inaugural guest. Thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your thoughts and ideas and for contributing to the discussion. We really appreciate you taking the time, and I hope that we will speak to you again in the future. Thank you again. And thank you to our listeners for joining us for our first edition of the Ship.Energy podcast. And if you have any thoughts to share on our discussion today, then there will be an opportunity to leave comments around the podcast window. Alternatively, please feel free to contact us via the Ship.Energy website. But, once again, Mark Cameron, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure, Mark. Thank you for the opportunity.
Very welcome, and have a good day.